people of the sword forced into our hands. Mustering in the millions, soldiers prepared for war by sharpening swords, cleaning pistols, polishing their boots, and readying the saddlebags for their cavalry horses. Flowers garlanded their paths to trains and ships, and words such as honor and glory were spoken with reverence. In his poem 1914, Rupert Brooke wrote of his thankfulness for this fine hour. To turn, as swimmers into cleanness leaping, glad from a world grown old and cold and weary. Many believed the war would be over by Christmas. Swept into this patriotic tide, Harvey and two of his brothers, Eric and Roy, enlisted in the army, while their sister Gladys volunteered as a nurse. The youngest, Bernard, stayed at home to help their mother run the farm. Before leaving for training, Harvey wandered the lane that led to the Redlands. In farewell, he embraced each of the trees along its border. While Private Harvey was learning to be a soldier, the true nature of the war manifested itself. Under the Schlieffen Plan, Germany intended a swift march through Belgium, followed by a broad sweep south, to envelop Paris. This decisive thrust would allow its armies to focus their attention on defeating Russia. They made quick early progress. Their huge artillery took mere hours to level Belgian forts that had stood for centuries. To forestall future local resistance, they torched villages and executed their inhabitants. It was a first shiver of the horrors to follow. As armies of a scale never seen before engaged one another, marshaling rifles, machine guns, high explosive shells, and even poison gas, deaths mounted at an alarming rate. In the west, the British and French slowed the German advance on Paris, then pushed it back. A series of flanking offensives and counteroffensives followed. In the east, the Russians threw themselves against German and Austro-Hungarian troops with abandon. By winter, any chance of a swift victory was lost. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers were already dead on both sides, and the murder mill of the trenches had only just begun. Now this struggle became what some predicted it always would be, a war of attrition and wholesale annihilation that enveloped countries around the globe. On March 29th, 1915, Harvey disembarked in Boulogne, France. After a frigid night bivouacked on a hillside, he climbed into a cattle truck packed with soldiers, and a train carried them toward the front in Belgium. Marching to reach Plug Street, or more formally, the Ploegstraat sector, his battalion passed a hastily dug graveyard, whose rotting stink made them wretch. Later, they dashed through woodland, threatened by gunfire. Finally, they scrambled into trenches, pooled with the heavy April rains. A sniper's bullet soon took the left eye of a private in their battalion. Another killed one of their lieutenants. At Plug Street and across the Western Front, death came from everywhere, every minute of every hour, up close. Most horrific of all was the shelling. "I must say it is a devilish affair altogether," wrote one soldier, who arrived at the front at the same time as Harvey. "You sit like rabbits in a burrow and just wait for something to come and blow you to hell." Jack Johnson's, whiz-bangs, woolly bears, minis, each type of shell had a name, each a distinctive sound. But there was little to do about any of them except tighten into a ball against the trench walls and hope. In spells of heavy shelling, the world erupted into flashing lights, mad screams, and concussive waves of sound that had an almost physical presence. The British lines alone suffered approximately 7,000 casualties daily. Wastage was how staff headquarters referred to the number of dead and wounded in their ledgers. Harvey managed to survive 3 months at Plug Street, then more in other nearby sectors. One trench looked the same as another. The battles were alike, too. He preferred patrols to waiting, passive, for shell fire in the trenches. Affectionately nicknamed the Little Man, Harvey was an expert scout. On August 3, 1915, he participated in a nighttime patrol led by his good friend, Raymond Knight. They discovered a German listening post hidden in some bushes. Knight attacked first. Harvey followed. He shot two men with his revolver and then chased after a third. Near the German lines, he knocked down the fleeing man with his bludgeon and grabbed his collar to take him prisoner. At that moment, a spray of bullets from the enemy trenches whistled past Harvey. Appearing out of nowhere, Knight yanked his friend to safety. For the incident, Harvey and Knight were awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal for conspicuous gallantry, recommended for a commission, and won a short leave home, where Harvey reunited with Anne. Throughout his time in the trenches, Harvey found comfort in the act of writing poetry in a small notebook he always kept on him. On trudging toward the lines, "This route march is a blighted thing. God what! The sun, how hot! No breeze, no pewter pot." On the death of the poet Rupert Brooke, "Joy diadems thy death to all, who loving thee loves beauty more. Since in thy death thou showest plain, though songs must cease and life must fall, the things that made the songs remain." On Gloucestershire, "I'm homesick for my hills again, my hills again, to see above the Severn plain, unscabbarded against the sky, the blue high blade of Cotswold lie." With his poems, Harvey found a welcome audience, initially with his mates in the trenches, then in the 5th Gloucester Gazette. The first of its kind, the regimental journal aimed to entertain and raise morale in the battalion. Harvey contributed many poems and other writings to it, and they were reprinted in newspapers far and wide under his initials, F.W.H. Their acclaim won him a publisher in Sidgwick and Jackson, which planned to release a collection entitled A Gloucestershire Lad, a couple of months after Harvey arrived at the front lines in Fokissar. When Harvey failed to return from his daytime scouting mission, most in his battalion thought him dead. A grieving Ivor Gurney wrote home, "His desire for nobility and sacrifice was insatiable and was at last his doom. But his friends may be excused for desiring a better ending than that probably of a sniper's bullet in no man's lands." Back in Gloucester, newsboys announced, "Local poet missing." "How did you get here?" one of the German soldiers asked Harvey, his hand forcing him against the trench wall. "Over no man's land, of course," he answered. "What were you doing?" "Patrolling." "Where is the rest of your patrol?" "There wasn't one." Suddenly, Harvey began to laugh. It was a mad kind of chuckle, born from shock and the uncanny resemblance of one of his captors to a Redlands farmhand. The two enemy soldiers stared at their prisoner, confused, then took him away. Harvey's reaction may have well saved him from a quick bullet to the head. At the rear of the trenches, a senior officer interrogated him on British artillery positions and the reasoning behind a recent attack by two divisions. "Oh, we have plenty of men," Harvey said casually. With that, he was delivered to the barracks in nearby Douai. Alone in a small room, the spell of adrenaline broken, Harvey started to realize the truth of his situation, something he had never imagined possible. He was a prisoner. He feared his battalion would send out a search party, and that his friends might die looking for him. He worried that Anne and his family might believe him lost forever. "By God," he declared, "they've got me." In his mind, he ran through the events leading to his capture, picking at what he could have done differently to avoid his ill fate. If only he had turned back after meeting his initial objective. Should he have assumed the dugout was occupied? Should he have fired his revolver and fled? He found no good answers, only a merry-go-round of more questions. Finally, he ceased that line of thought. He was where he was, and that was the end of it. Hungry, harassed by lice, he opened his pocketbook Shakespeare and read several sonnets to pass the time. Soon the light grew too dim to read, but he continued to recite the lines from memory. When sleep eluded him, he took a small dose from the vial of morphine he always brought with him on patrols in case he was wounded in no man's land. Soft dreams followed, but he awakened a prisoner all the same. In the morning he wrote a poem called Solitary Confinement on the flyleaf of a dusty French book someone had left in the room. It began, "No mortal comes to visit me today, only the gay and early rising sun, who strolled in nonchalantly just to say, 'Good morrow and despair not, foolish one.'" For 10 days, Harvey remained in Douai, surviving by the motto, "Shakespeare for the light, morphia for the night." Then he and several other prisoners were sent by train across the border into Germany. Left to sit on the floor of their fourth-class carriage, they endured cross looks from soldiers who occupied the single row of benches in the compartment. At station stops, some civilians on the platform shouted, "Nein, Engländer!" through the windows. For the most part, though, they were treated decently along the way. Harvey even befriended one of the guards, who spoke some pidgin English and had earned an Iron Cross on the Russian front. When he asked when the war might end, the guard said, "Krieg, nix gut, Deutschland kaputt, France kaputt, Russia kaputt, England kaputt, alles kaputt." Their journey concluded in the middle of the night with a screeching halt at Gütersloh, an industrial town in Westphalia, Germany. From the station, they trekked to the town's outskirts, where a boot-shaped assembly of buildings stood ringed in light and pine trees. Built as an insane asylum a couple of years before the war, the Gütersloh facility was now a prison camp for 1,200 officers. Harvey and the others were led into a building block painted with a big letter H. Guards searched them one by one, placing all their belongings on a long table, keeping whatever items suited them. Then each prisoner was interrogated and given a piece of black bread as compensation for the grilling. Afterward, they were stripped and their clothes taken away for fumigation. Once deloused and showered, the prisoners sat in an empty room until guards finally returned their clothes. Then came inoculations, injections into the chest and arm for a litany of diseases. They remained in quarantine in Block H for several days, removed from the hundreds of other British, Irish, French, Belgian, and Russian prisoners who gathered outside in the sandy grounds during the day. Harvey met a pair of RFC pilots, one of whom told him about being paraded naked through Ostend after he was shot down at sea. "Bad sportsman," the pilot said. He had informed his captors as much. When they were finally allowed into the main prison, Harvey and the pilots quickly came to learn what most prisoners knew about their German captors. "Frontline troops have some respect for each other," noted one British officer. "But the farther from the front you get, the more bellicose and beastly the people become." Chapter 3. "There is to be a big push shortly. Every bit of energy must be concentrated on the task." General Hugh Boom, Trenchard, spoke in the thunderous voice, and with the hard-charging attitude that had earned him his nickname. It was the second week of September 1916, and he was traveling from aerodrome to aerodrome, delivering his message to the RFC squadrons. The British were bringing a new engine of war to break through the lines, the tank. The RFC would be critical to the success of the offensive. "We must shoot all Huns on sight and give them no rest. Our bombers should make life a burden on the enemy lines. Reconnaissance jobs must be completed at all costs." In essence, Trenchard repeated the simple tactical directive sent earlier by one of his squadron commanders. "Attack everything!" At Le Hameau Aerodrome in northern France, Captain David Gray accepted these orders with his usual aplomb. A flight leader in the No. 11 Squadron, the RFC's first fighter group, and home of several of its finest aces, aggression in the sky was his specialty. Trimly built, with an erect posture and a neatly pressed uniform, he was every inch the military man. his stern glance, accentuated by a ruler straight part in his hair, high forehead, trim mustache, and hatchet nose, marked an officer who brooked no compromise with himself or his command. On September 15th, after a half hour of heavy artillery bombardment of the German lines that one pilot likened to a solid gray wool carpet of shellbursts, British soldiers rose from their trenches in a major offensive, aided by tanks clearing a path and providing gunfire cover through no man's land. The troops overran a 9,000-yard stretch of the first line of German trenches, and some of the second. Gray, his observer Leonard Helder, and scores of other RFC air crews flew day and night, both before and after the initial ground attack. Beyond the threats of Archie and mechanical failure, they also faced reinvigorated attacks from German fighter squadrons, who brought a new type of plane into the fray. One British pilot later described in his diary the speed of this new German aircraft. "The next moment I saw a Fokker biplane coming toward us. It gained on us so quick and was so infinitely superior that I made for a cloud and got to it just in time." Since the war began, there had been a back-and-forth struggle between the Allies and the Germans over who ruled the skies over Western Europe. Part depended on the quality of air crews, their tactics, and the latest aeronautical developments. Part hung on the combatants' sheer force of will. At the start of 1916, Trenchard made clear that he wanted to overwhelm the Germans, best planes or not, with non-stop patrols and deep penetration behind enemy lines. Throughout late spring and summer, he largely had his way, but at the severe cost of exhausting his men, and of losing many of them. The RFC was increasingly seen as a suicide club, and a pilot who lasted a few weeks on the front was considered an absolute master. Air crews were not issued parachutes, and when they prepared emergency kits with rations, maps, and other gear to allow them to survive if shot down, their commanders castigated them for showing an unwillingness to fight to the bitter end. With the big September push and increased German resistance, the butcher's bill steepened rapidly. The RFC now approached the most gruesome wastage rate of the entire war, when pilots and observers could expect to survive only 17 and a half hours in the air before becoming casualty statistics. "It was bloody murder," one fighter leader said. New pilots arrived almost daily to take the place of crews who did not return. What the British command did not yet know was that Oswald Bülke, the fearsome German ace, was back on the Western Front. An aggressive, practiced pilot, the 25-year-old Bülke was also a keen tactical thinker. In the first half of the year, he shot down 13 planes. The German Air Force had sent him to the east for the summer, but in late August, with the RFC again holding supremacy in the skies, they ordered him back in an effort to turn the tide. Bülke started a new squadron, the Jagdstaffel, whose purpose was to hunt British planes. He recruited the best pilots, including the young Baron Manfred von Richthofen, the future Red Baron. Bülke demanded that his squadron be fully supplied with a new Albatross D-3, a fast, easily handled biplane with two fixed guns. He had already experienced its effectiveness over the Somme. With the imminent arrival of these planes and his soon-to-be-tested tactic of coordinated assault, his Jagdstaffel promised to be a vicious force. Back at their aerodromes in France, Allied pilots chronicled the rising threat in flight logs, diaries, and letters home. However, they mostly tried to relax between their flying missions. They took walks, rode horses, drank French port, played bridge, listened to music on the gramophone, and sang songs. There was comfort in the farmhouses and chateaus they inhabited, where they tried to forget the woofed, woofed, woofed of anti-artillery, and the sight of friends plummeting in corkscrews to the earth, their planes on fire or split in two. Even so, at breakfast on September 17th, Gray could not help but notice the pair of empty seats and the dark mood around the tables in the Le Hameau mess hall. The men drank their tea and drew heavily on cigarettes. Their hands shook, their eyes glazed over in a thousand-yard stare, and their faces were fixed in a rictus of tension from the constant cold, wind, and threat of death in the sky. Two members of their squadron had been shot down the day before. With dawn approaching, it was soon time to go back into the deathly fray. Gray reviewed his morning mission, pinned to the notice board. Lead a six-plane fighter escort on a bombing run to the Marquion rail junction to disrupt the German resupply of men and ammunition at the Somme. He suited up in preparation for the attack ahead. At 30 years of age, Gray was the old man in his squadron. Few, if any, had his military experience, including action under fire. His fighters and the bomber crews they were protecting would need every bit of it. David Gray spent the first 7 years of his life on a tea plantation hewed out of the dense Indian jungles of Upper Assam. It was a land both beautiful and perilous, of misted rivers and dense canopies of palm trees, of insufferable heat, monsoons, malaria, cobras, and leopards that preyed in the dark. In the late 18th century, explorers for the East India Company discovered tea trees growing in the jungle, and an industry was born to rival Chinese tea production. In 1874, newlyweds, Dr. Edward and Helen Gray, took a six-month sea voyage from England, then journeyed by paddle steamer up the swirling brown currents of the Brahmaputra River to Assam. Edward had been recruited by the Jorhat Tea Company to run a medical clinic for the British staff and the hundreds of locals who worked the estates. In addition to his doctor's salary, he was paid a percentage of the company's profits. In a bamboo-framed thatched bungalow set amid 15 acres of hillside tea garden and surrounded by jungle, Edward and Helen started their family. David was born in 1884, the seventh of nine children. Two of his siblings died from the many fevers that plagued the area. When David was almost eight, the family returned to England. Dr. Gray opened a surgical practice in London, and they lived in a townhouse in the well-heeled neighborhood bordering Regent's Park. The culture shock was profound, but David adapted quickly. Instead of hide-and-seek in the jungle, he now played cricket and polo with great elan. He settled early on an army career, perhaps in rebellion against his father, who had a penchant for practical jokes, business schemes, and too much sherry, and attended the Royal Military Academy in Woolwich, in the southeast of London. Founded by King George II, and known as the Shop, the Academy's students were destined to be sappers, combat engineers who built roads and bridges and laid and cleared mines, and artillery officers. A shrill trumpet called Reveille daily at 6:15 a.m. After a parade, cadets attended lectures in the ivy-clad red-brick buildings on everything from history and mathematics to electricity, fortifications, and explosives. They built wooden mountings for 80-ton artillery guns and soldered shell casings. They surveyed hills using three-legged plane tables and dug long tunnels with pickaxes and shovels across the campus grounds. Upon graduation, Gray was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Royal Garrison Artillery and stationed in a fort on the Red Sea. He was 19. 2 years later, wishing to return to the country of his birth, Gray joined the 48th Pioneers of the British Indian Army and was based first in Bareilly, then Allahabad, in the northern reaches of the British Raj. Although an infantry regiment, the pioneers specialized in constructing bridges, fortifications, and roads in the often impassable Indian landscape. Gray was well-liked both by his soldiers and by the officers above him, and was promoted to lieutenant. His record read, "A capable and efficient officer, good eye for country, has tact and judgment, energetic and self-reliant." Positions as quartermaster and adjutant followed, then a promotion to captain. Despite his quick advancement and military bearing, Gray also had the understated air of an adventurer. He sank himself into the varied cultures in which he lived. Languages came to him as easily as bad habits did to others. His nickname in India was Munshi, teacher of tongues. Besides English, he spoke serviceable French, German, Russian, Bengali, Hindi, and Arabic, as well as a healthy smattering of several others. Soon after the outbreak of World War I, the 48th Pioneers embarked from Bombay with the 6th, Pune, Division of the British Indian Army. Their transport ship steamed up the Persian Gulf and anchored at the mouth of the Shat al-Arab, the river created from the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates. The British needed to ensure a steady supply of oil from Mesopotamia. For that, they had to maintain dominance in the region, first by wresting control of Basra from the Turks. Within days of the pioneers' arrival, Gray led a machine gun company in a fierce fight to take Kut az-Zain, a fort manned by 4,500 Turks that protected the advance toward Basra. Although slowed by torrential rains and a mirage that confounded the artillery, the British division cleared the fort. Gray thrived in his first test of combat. The division then forced marched 30 miles across the desert to take Basra from the fleeing Turks. The town of 60,000 Muslims and Christians, located amid palm groves and tidal waterways, was essentially a level patch of land that flooded twice a day. There was little potable water and no infrastructure to encamp an army. Between sporadic fights with the Turks, the 48th Pioneers labored against the alluvial mud to make Basra habitable and secure for their division. In spring 1915, Allied biplanes of the newly founded Indian Royal Flying Corps soared over Basra, scouting Turkish movements in the deserts to the north. Like many others in the army, the sight inspired Gray. Here were masters of the air, flying engineered marvels, able to evade or engage the enemy on their own terms. As an RFC historian noted, the war most soldiers were fighting fell far short of the heroic tales of old. There were no gleaming rows of lancers, no saber charges of hussars and dragoons, no epic stands of the thin red line, no stirrup charges staged by the Scots, Greys, and Black Watch. It was drab khaki, mud, blood, and apparently there was no end to the carnage. Only the bright blue sky seemed worth fighting for. Later that year, Gray returned to London to claim a spot in the RFC flight school at Hendon. The Air Force was desperate for men of his background, and he was able to answer a definitive yes to the question, "Do you ride?" After earning his wings in January 1916, he distinguished himself flying for a home defense squadron, then another in France, before the elite No. 11 recruited him to its fighter ranks. He was schooled in dogfighting by Albert Ball, Britain's most famous ace. Soon he became a flight leader, known in the squadron for his preternatural calm. After a dismal breakfast in the mess hall, Gray and Helder took off in their trusted Farman Experimental FE-2B. Helder, who had been slated for a musical scholarship at Cambridge before the war, was an experienced observer, and he and Gray made a fine team. Their British-built two-seater, with its V-shaped structure, stab of a tailplane, and 160-horsepower engine, had served them well on numerous missions. It carried colored streamers on the tail to mark it as the escort leader. Minutes after clearing the aerodrome, the plane's engine began to knock, and Gray signaled the five other escorts to return. Ground crews prepared another FE, this one new, fresh off the factory line. To the RFC, though, new meant untested and prone to fault. Gray ascended into the air again, this time without much confidence in his machine, but because of a low fog, the run was postponed again, and they returned to base. At 9:30 a.m., he lifted off from Le Hamo for the third time. His friend, Lionel Morris, with whom he had learned to fly, was second lead. The sky was now clear and bright, As they circled at 10,000 feet, awaiting the arrival of the bombers, they could spy the white cliffs of Dover in the distance. Although it was wonderful to see their homeland, the clear skies guaranteed attack from German fighters, and the lack of clouds meant an absence of places to hide. To the north, Helder sighted the dozen bombers from the No. 16 squadron. They were slow but sturdy BE-2Cs, carrying 20 and 112-pound eggs under their carriages. Gray waggled his wings, the signal for Morris and the other escort pilots to tighten into a diamond formation. A red flare from the lead bomber indicated the mission was a go. With Marquand 35 miles away, the journey would be short. Before crossing the front, Helder fired his Lewis gun to warm up its action. No sooner had their ears stopped ringing from their own gunfire when bursts of Archie surrounded them. All the planes sailed unharmed through the barrage. As they continued eastward, no German attackers materialized, and after a short time they spotted the sun's reflection shining from the railway track that ran to Marquand. Perhaps fortune was shining on them, and the run would come off without interference. The bombers were below them, at 6,000 feet, and they now zeroed in on the railway junction. Gray maintained his escort's position above, where they could prevent any diving attacks from the enemy. All his crews kept a sharp eye out. The eggs dropped one after the next over Marquand. Explosions rocked the air and sent up mushroom clouds of black smoke. One must have hit an ammunition dump because the resulting blast jolted its bomber upward in a column of smoke and flying debris. The pilot recovered and, job well done by all, the bomber squadron turned back toward the west. Gray and the other escorts circled over the junction one last time, and seeing no fighters, turned to follow the bombers home. Then, "Fokkers!" Helder screamed through the rush of air. Suddenly the sky was alive with planes emblazoned with the black iron cross, swooping in from the blind of the sun. Flying their newly arrived Albatross fighters, Boelke and his Jagdstaffel drove home the surprise attack. One British bomber was ripped to pieces before it could take evasive maneuvers. Gray banked, then dove downward to protect the others, thinking nothing of his own safety. Watching the Fokkers for any change in their direction, he gauged his angle of descent to maximize the FE's arc of fire. Knees braced against the sides of the cockpit, Helder stood on his seat to man the Lewis gun. Its spit of bullets, and those from other FEs, cut through the air. An Albatross exploded into a ball of flame. Gray and Helder's quick and courageous actions gave the other bombers the seconds they needed to escape to the west. Now the scarlet and black Albatross formation cartwheeled around to focus on the six escort fighters. Assembled in batches, they swarmed the British with the bewildering force and speed that would later earn the Jagdstaffel its sobriquet, the Flying Circus. A close quarter rake of bullets from Boelke ripped through Gray's engine and shredded an aileron. Propeller stopped, balance control lost, the plane plummeted into a spin. Boelke hounded them as Gray tried to recover, and Helder hung on to a strut to avoid being flung out. The German ace continued to target the escort leader, the quickest way to throw the British into disarray, and emptied his drum on the falling plane. Bullets punctured the petrol tank and shredded a wing. The plane rendered useless, its pilots having little chance to survive such a stalled plunge. Boelke swung away to single out another fighter. The others in the Jagdstaffel swerved and sideslipped through the air in an elegant but deadly pursuit. One of them, Richthofen, aiming for his first victory, chased after Morris, the second lead of the British squadron. Meanwhile, ground approaching, the world a dizzying swirl of sky and black smoke, Gray fought the unwieldy controls of his FE to recover from the spin. Nothing worked. The altimeter quickly spun downward. 4,000 feet. 3,000. 2,000. Gray wrenched the stick back and forth and pressed on the foot controls to adjust the rudder, yet the plane spiraled toward the ground as petrol sprayed from its punctured tank. 1,000 feet. 500 feet. Still, Gray struggled to regain control. With a sudden calm, the plane stopped its corkscrew, and Gray leveled out. He attempted to restart the engine, but it was shot dead. Moments later, he crash-landed into a field crowded with German infantry and a reconnaissance balloon. Face lacerated with cuts, arm broken, he crawled out of the plane. Helder also survived the crash. A match ensured the FE, already soaked with petrol, quickly lit up in flames. A safe distance from the blaze, soldiers encircled the British airmen. A gray-haired officer approached, his Luger leveled at their heads. Gray and Helder raised their arms. "You are my prisoners, gentlemen," he said in proper English, as their plane broke apart in the flames. At that moment, overhead, Richthofen put one last burst of bullets into the plane flown by Morris. It fell sideways and crashed behind some trees, 500 yards from where Gray and Helder stood, unable to do anything but watch. Their German captor kept his pistol trained on them, seemingly confused over what to do next. "Mind if we put our hands down?" Gray asked, too much in pain, too distressed over seeing his friend go down, to care much about the danger his words might put him in. Once reassured they were unarmed, the officer directed them to lower their arms. He introduced himself as Mueller and asked them some questions, then led them to a truck at the edge of the field. They were driven off toward nearby Cambrai. On the way, they came upon Morris's F.E., half-buried in a road embankment. A crowd of German soldiers had gathered around the plane, which was now a grim tangle of wire, torn cloth, and splintered wood. Mueller told his driver to stop the truck. Gray could not see Morris, but his observer was still in the cockpit, clearly dead. Gray insisted on knowing the pilot's fate. Mueller made some inquiries and learned that an ambulance had taken a severely injured Morris to hospital. With that, the truck continued to the Citadel. Gray remained quiet for the short ride. He blamed himself for the devastation of his squadron. As much as he had prepared them for the mission, as much as he had tried to do everything right, the Germans had bested him, and his crews had paid a dear price. For a man like Gray, raised in the army tradition of "fixed bayonets and die like British soldiers do," capture was a black mark of shame, akin to desertion or a self-inflicted wound. He had no choice except surrender, but that did not lessen the blow. At Cambrai, a medic set Gray's broken arm, then soldiers hustled him and Helder through the stone fortress, down a narrow, dark stairwell to the cellars, just as they had done with Cecil Blaine 6 weeks before. "The war is over for you," one said in English. Other soldiers spoke to Gray in German, but not once did he let on that he understood them. Ever present of mind, he knew his proficiency in the language would be an advantage if it remained hidden. The soldiers put him and Helder into a large cell with double-tier wooden bunks. It was already occupied by several crews from the Marquand run, and also, to their great relief, the two No. 11 squadron officers who had not returned from their mission the day before. At least they were alive. The next day, the interrogations started. Neither Gray nor his countrymen gave away any information, despite questions about their squadrons, their planes, aerodrome locations, how they communicated target positions with artillery battalions on the ground. Afterward, they were returned to their cells to stew. The following morning, waking up on a straw mattress, the fastidious Gray was disgusted to find his shirt populated by lice. Later, several Jagdstaffel officers visited the British crews to gloat. The Germans' bandbox blue-gray parade uniforms struck a contrast to their own soiled, bloodied outfits, further darkening the mood in the cell. Their demoralization turned to despair when more RFC crews arrived, having been shot down by the Jagdstaffel. Then the news came that Lionel Morris and another pilot had died in the hospital. Their deaths came as a terrible blow to Gray. On September 26th, he and the others were marched out of Cambrai and onto a third-class train carriage headed for Germany. They stopped in Douai, Valenciennes, Brussels, Liège, and other towns. The battered ruins affording them a close look at the effects of war. Everything looked shrouded in a veil of gloom, and the streets were crowded with pale-faced widows dressed in black. At Aachen, they knew they were finally across the German border. During a particularly slow crawl from station to station, one pilot made an effort at humor, joking, "Why do so many stations have the same name? I've seen several called Ausgang." In Cologne, they were allowed to disembark and follow those exit signs from the train platform, but only to sit for hours in an underground waiting room while German civilians eyed them as if they were a pestilence. Finally, another train brought them to Gütersloh. In the quarantine building, Block H, Gray surveyed his new surroundings, which were suitably better than Cambrai and much less secure. From what prisoners working in the building said, the commandant was reasonable, the food decent, and they were even allowed to play tennis. Gray drew Helder aside and, in an even tone, suggested that the time was right to plan an escape. The thought of remaining a prisoner through to the end of the war was something Gray could not abide. But on September 29th, before their 10-day quarantine period ended, soldiers escorted Gray and Helder back to the local railway station. Already corralled on the train were 26 other Gütersloh prisoners, all of them RFC. Demands to know the reason for their assembly, and their destination, were met with silence. The train clanked its way northward. Gray was seated across from a young pilot he had never met, Cecil Blaine. Gray watched as Blaine engaged in a whispered conversation with his seatmate. A guard, suspicious of their conspiratorial tone, stomped over and began haranguing the two prisoners in German. Blaine pantomimed both innocence and incomprehension, as if involved in an elaborate game of charades. The guard attempted to silence him, but Blaine continued to gesticulate wildly until finally bursting out in laughter. The vexed guard slammed his rifle butt between the pilot's feet, shouted a few words of warning, and strode off. Blaine then shared with his seatmate the gist of what the guard had said. Gray took note of all of this, appreciating Blaine's cleverness in hiding his understanding of German. The man had spirit. Several hours later, the train pulled into Osnabrück station, and the airmen plodded through the streets in a cold downpour to the edge of town. Guards drew them up in a line beside a 12-foot-high brick wall. A gate cut into the wall was opened from the inside, and they were led into a narrow, graveled courtyard. Before them stood a 4-story barracks. Once inside, Gray and the others learned that their party comprised almost the sum total of British POWs held there. The others were French and Russian. Locked together in a single room, its windows painted white and nailed shut, the 28 men awaited what was to come. They were segregated from the other prisoners, and the condemnatory looks of their guards, who brought the sparest of meals, raw fish and gherkins, began to fester worry. When Gray, the senior British officer among them, asked why they were not in the general barracks with the other prisoners, and when they might be joining them, he was told simply, "I don't know. Tomorrow, perhaps." Rumors, then information supplied to them by the prison commandant, Captain Blankenstein, proved they had just cause for concern. On September 3rd, RFC pilot William Leif Robinson had destroyed a Zeppelin airship flying high over North London, the first time a German airship had been downed on such a bombing raid. Its 16 crew members, young men, mostly in their early 20s, went down with the flaming ship. In retribution, the German high command intended to put twice that number of British airmen in front of a firing squad. Chapter 4. October 9th, 1916. It was to be a short flight, his first in France. Caspar Kennard intended only to feel out his BE-2C reconnaissance plane and get his bearings around Saint-Omer. Air mechanic Ben Digby, whose oil-smeared face looked barely old enough to manage a beard, accompanied as observer and guide, since he had been fixing planes at the RFC's main aerodrome for several months, and knew the area well. Minutes after takeoff, Kennard was already in trouble. The engine was rattling as they headed southeastward. He could not coax the plane to climb higher than 2,000 feet. From the forward cockpit, Digby turned to signal they were crossing over the trenches at an altitude that put them in range of small arms fire. They needed to circle back. As Kennard banked around, the plane was consumed by a huge cloud. Wisps of murky white vapor blinded him, and he lost all sense of direction. Again, he throttled up the engine, hoping to climb into clear skies, but the plane would not respond. Then, in an instant, they were free of the cloud, only to discover themselves straight over the enemy trench lines, low enough to see individual German soldiers. There was no escape. Black shell bursts surrounded them. Fragments tore through the fuel tank with a terrible hiss. One shell exploded directly under the port side wing, tipping the plane over on its side before sending it into a nosedive. Kennard fought to regain control. Still, they plummeted. In the frenzy, Digby was sure his pilot had been hit. He began to climb from his seat to take over the stick. Kennard waved him away. As they fell, more Archie boomed around the plane, followed by cracks of rifle fire from the lines. Then, with a shuddering jolt, they hit the ground. The tail of the plane almost sheared off. They bounced and careened through a field before coming to a halt. Rooted in their seats, Kennard and Digby were both stunned that they had actually survived the crash. In the last moment, Kennard must have righted the plane enough to avoid hitting the ground head-on, but he could not recall how he had done it. Kennard had been flying solo for only 24 hours. 7 months before, he had been living in the Argentine Pampas, working as a hand on a 20,000-acre ranch. It was a long way from his homeland, Kent, England, where he was born into the landed gentry. The Kennards owned a large estate outside Maidstone and produced hops. Casper spent his early years in the family's stately home, Frith Hall, then attended Felsted School in Essex, a private boarding school. On graduation, he decided against university. With his older brother Keith set to inherit the estate, there was little future for him at Frith Hall. He decided to make his own way in the world and left on a steamer ship for South America. Through his extended family, he gained an introduction to J.C. Douglas, the owner of an expansive ranch in Argentina. Soon after, he found himself speaking pidgin Spanish and spending all day in a saddle herding cattle. By April 1916, with newspaper accounts and letters from home chronicling the German advances at Verdun, Kennard could no longer remain on the sidelines. He returned to England and joined the RFC. 25 years old, tall and big-boned, he looked like he could wrestle a steer to the ground with little trouble. A bushy mustache, dark, slicked-back hair and bronzed skin, and the carved wooden pipe perpetually stuck between his teeth added to the overall South American cowboy effect. After earning his wings in late June, he served in a reserve squadron before being sent to Saint-Omer in October. It had taken him less than a week to be shot down. A company of German soldiers surrounded Kennard and Digby before they could climb out of the plane. They took them to a holding camp, somewhere behind the German lines, Kennard wrote to his parents 3 days later. Although lucky to be alive, he described being consumed by one big feeling of disappointment. You can imagine how we feel. It was my first flight to the lines, and to have to come down without ever having had a decent scrap of it. Days later, their captors took Digby to a German camp for common soldiers and sent Kennard to Gütersloh. The airman did not remain there for long. Hungry for more than bitter soup, bristling against his imprisonment, and desperate to be back in a fight he had only just joined, Kennard looked for any opportunity to escape. When a guard making the lunch rounds came to his cell, Kennard hurled him against the wall, sprinted through the door, and turned the key, locking the guard in. He found himself alone in the hallway, with no plans for where to go next. If he stepped out of the building and tried to make a run for the gate in broad daylight, he would be shot by guards. If he hid out until dark, he would be found missing at roll call, and a search would ensue. Resigned to his rash mistake, he sat down and waited to be discovered. As a consequence of his action, the Germans delivered him straight away to Osnabrück, where Commandant Blankenstein had him thrown in a solitary cell, giving no indication when or if he would be allowed to join the general barracks. Kennard was beginning to understand that the Germans had no intention of abiding by the international agreements governing the treatment of prisoners of war. "Those vanquished in war are held to belong to the victor," stated Aristotle. And indeed, for most of the history of humankind, death or enslavement awaited soldiers captured on the battlefield. Often their families suffered the same fate, and homes and entire villages of those defeated in battle would be razed. Egyptian, Greek, Mongol, Persian, Viking, Aztec, Slav, Roman. The only difference was location. Brutality was strength. Mercy, weakness. To warn against further resistance, a Byzantine emperor blinded 14,000 prisoners and sent them home in columns led by the one man out of every 100 from whom he had taken only a single eye. Neither philosophy nor religion made any provision in how an enemy combatant was treated. Christian crusaders and Muslim conquerors alike routinely killed those who surrendered to them. During the Middle Ages, there was a stir of change, albeit not a benevolent one. Knights serving their kings bore the brunt of the cost of war, bringing men-at-arms and horse archers into the battle with them. To offset the expense, these noble warriors took many prisoners to hold to ransom. The captives' chances depended on their status and bloodline, an early signal that a soldier's rank decided his treatment. Seeing an opportunity, merchants opened shops to trade in ransoms. In 1347, a good French knight listed in Calais for £1,500. Of course, captors had to pay a share to their lords if the latter did not simply take the best prizes for themselves. Enrichment did not, however, supplant the bloodthirsty rage of some conquerors during this epoch. At the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, Henry V of England set his army loose on his surrendered enemy, the French. Later, a historian chronicled the brutal fate of these vanquished soldiers. Sticked with daggers, brained with pole axes, slain with mauls, others had their throats cut, and some their bellies paunched. In 1625, the Dutch legal theorist and former prison escapee, Hugo Grotius, published his seminal work on the Law of War and Peace, demanding that nations commit to a set of international rules between warring parties, including for those captured on the battlefield. A short while later, during the English Civil War, Parliament stated that none shall kill an enemy who yields and throws down his arms. Of course, without agreement from both sides, or consequences for violation, these regulations and norms amounted to empty promises. Slowly, however, there was cause for hope in the event of surrender. The Age of Reason put a value on the individual above how he might serve the state. Prisoners were merely men whose life no one has a right to take, declared Jean-Jacques Rousseau. With the rise of professional armies in the 18th century, internment and POW exchanges became more standardized. France's King Louis XV instructed his officers to treat the vanquished British like your own. Nonetheless, the British and French, particularly during the Napoleonic Age, ran a race to the bottom in their handling of the captured, many of whom were interned in the dark, sodden underbellies of moored ships, or hulks. Some American soldiers in the Revolutionary War died in these same sinkholes of filth, vermin, infectious disease, and despair, as prisoners of the British outside New York City. On the heels of the formation of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva in 1863, Abraham Lincoln made a marked leap forward by codifying some principles of prisoner treatment in an Army field manual, not the least of which stated that POWs should be given the basic needs of shelter, food, clothing, and medical attention. in 1899, and again in 1907. Delegations from across the globe gathered in The Hague, the Netherlands, to civilize war. Beyond stipulations on diplomacy, naval warfare, and restrictions over the use of poisonous gases and hollow-point bullets, the two international conferences set out clear rules about the treatment of prisoners. It was forbidden to kill or wound an enemy combatant who had surrendered his arms or who could not defend himself. Prisoners must be humanely treated on the same footing as the troops of the government who captured them. Enlisted soldiers, but not officers, could be used for labor, but the tasks were not to be excessive nor related to the war. Finally, relief societies were to be allowed to channel aid to prisoners. Germany, Britain, France, Russia, Italy, the United States, and Austria-Hungary, among many other nations, agreed to these conventions. Such was the laundry list of do's and don'ts. A British international lawyer stated in 1911 that the future POW, a spoilt darling, could expect a halcyon time to be nursed fondly in memory, a kind of inexpensive rest cure after the wearisome turmoil of fighting. None of the diplomats gathered in The Hague in 1899 or 1907 could have anticipated the vast populations of prisoners that would come out of industrialized total war, nor the challenges this would involve. In the first 6 months of World War I, 1.3 million soldiers became POWs across Europe. Combatant nations struggled to confine and maintain this tide of men, and there was no sign that it would ebb anytime soon. By mid-1916, Germany held 1.65 million men in an archipelago of prison camps across the country. Its treatment of the British, let alone the French and Russians, was far from the high standard of civilized war promised by the Hague Conventions and the like. In the act of surrender on the Western Front, 1 in 5 British soldiers was shot or bayoneted. The moans of wounded in no man's land were often silenced the same way, or men were simply left to die on stretchers behind the lines. Those who reached field hospitals often perished from neglect, as German doctors would frequently carry through on their Hippocratic oath only after attending to their own countrymen. Individual acts of kindness occurred in these first hours of captivity, but they were far from the general rule. Before being brought to Germany, soldiers were carefully relieved of watches, money, cigarettes, wedding rings, and even boots. More out of tradition than adherence to the Hague Conventions, officers were separated from the rank and file, who were to suffer the worst in captivity. At the start of the war, their camps were overcrowded cities of mere tents, surrounded by sentry boxes and barbed wire fences. Some held 30,000 to 50,000 prisoners. Wood-slatted huts eventually replaced the canvas shelters, but the improvement only offered an excuse to pack in more men. Lack of food, threadbare clothes, poor sanitation, and bitter winters meant that disease ran rampant. In winter 1914-15, an outbreak of typhus at Wittenberg Camp prompted the Germans manning the facility to abandon its interior and restrict patrols to the perimeter. Supplies were delivered in by chute. Eventually, 6 British doctors volunteered to enter the camp to tend to the unfortunate men, a mix of their own countrymen and French and Russian prisoners. 3 of the doctors died. Those who survived reported unlit rooms where the sick wandered around delirious or shared a mattress with the already dead. "The patients were alive with vermin," one report stated. In the half-light, a doctor attempted to brush what he took to be an accumulation of dust from the folds of a patient's clothes, and he discovered it to be a moving mass of lice. Roughly 80% of enlisted men taken prisoner were forced to work for the Germans. Small numbers of fortunate ones, often the recovering wounded, served as orderlies in officer prison camps, cooking meals and cleaning rooms, like Jeeves of old. Volunteers for these positions were easy to find. The majority of enlisted suffered hard labor in Arbeitskommandos, work parties. They dug in the salt and coal mines, plowed fields, cut peat, split rocks in quarries, laid railroads, emptied barges, and worked in factories. They were treated little better than slaves, and flogged and abused the same. For a period, their death rates were greater than those on the front lines. According to one historian, some 50,000 Allied troops and civilians